This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. Great to have you company this week for a conversation that I think is an important one, but like a lot of important conversations, it's not an entirely comfortable one. It's a conversation about evil and deception and the capacity for deception that evil people can demonstrate. You'll be aware of the phrase, the banality of evil, coined by Hannah Arendt after she witnessed the trial of Nazi official Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem in 1961. Eichmann had been a logistics guy during the Second World War. He was deeply involved in facilitating the extermination of European Jews, and he was captured by the Allies in 1945, but escaped to Argentina, where he lived for several years until he was captured again by Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, and taken to Jerusalem for trial. At that trial, what Hannah Arendt thought she witnessed was a man devoid of ideology, a mindless cog in the Nazi war machine, and an example of how evil can be, as the famous phrase has it, banal rather than something colourful or dramatic. It's a theory of evil that's gone on to be popular but also very controversial. And this week I'm talking about it with Matthew Sharp, who's an associate professor in philosophy at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. Matt Sharp is going to be delivering the annual Simone Weil lecture at ACU later this month, and he'll be talking about Eichmann, evil and deception. The banality of evil is one of those catchy phrases that have passed into everyday use, but I think a lot of the time when people do use it, they're not necessarily using it in the way that Hannah Arendt did. So what was she talking about or writing about when she coined that phrase?
So the term comes out of her 1963 book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which she subtitled A Report on the Banality of Evil. And so it's a category or an idea that she thought described this figure of Adolf Eichmann, which I'm sure audience members will know. He was a leading figure, a central figure in the administrative organization of the Shoah. He was the principal organizer of the deportation trains that took Jewish men and women, and of course Gypsy and other minorities as well, to the various camps around Europe, including to the death camps. And what struck Arendt about the way Eichmann presented himself in the trial at Jerusalem, which was 1961, was that he wasn't demonic. He wasn't charismatic. He wasn't in any way a kind of Mephistophelian figure. There was nothing glamorous about him. She was convinced by what he had to say that he wasn't even really a convinced Nazi. He wasn't a convinced or deep anti-Semite. He was a kind of office clerk, an ordinary bureaucrat who she thought was thoughtless, that thought in administrative jargon and thought in these kinds of weird cliches that he would come up with, that he would recur to at particular moments where, if you like, external reality and the reality that he was sending people, as he knew, to their certain deaths. When that reality threatened to intrude, it seemed to Arendt that he would just go back to these kinds of formulaic cliches, which more or less sort of created a bubble around him between him and the reality of what he was doing. And so it's that kind of thoughtlessness that Arendt thought was kind of mundane, banal, almost comic rather than devilish or glamorous or pointing to anything, you know, really profound about Eichmann. He was just a clerk doing his job, doing his duty, as she presented things anyway. And it was because of that that he was able to so efficiently organize the train schedules and send people, as I say, to their certain deaths, which he most certainly knew about and understood.
So the banality of evil then, I guess, in the abstract, if you like, it refers to how enormous crimes like the Holocaust can be the work of functionaries within a machine, not the work of sort of monsters or Satan-like individuals, which is a very controversial idea. And you've quite rightly described Eichmann in Jerusalem as one of the most controversial books of the 20th century. Can we talk a bit more about that? I mean, why has it been so controversial?
Look, there are a number of reasons why Arendt's book has been so controversial, only one of which is this claim that Adolf Eichmann was, in Arendt's view, a banal individual, somebody we might be working alongside. That's only one of the reasons. I mean, the book also contains a good deal of historical analysis of the mechanics of the Shoah. And in that context, Arendt very famously made comments concerning the role of the Jewish councils in working with the Nazis that historians and others have felt were both inaccurate and certainly insensitive, implying a kind of almost complicity, co-complicity of the Jewish leaders of Europe in this crime, which seemed to many to obviate, that is, not take into account the way that the people who were involved in these Jewish councils, who organised the ghettos and kept peace within the ghettos, ran police services within the ghettos to keep order, they were themselves under threat of their own lives. And they had also been threatened by the SS that if they didn't comply, a lot worse things could happen a lot more quickly. And Arendt was accused by many critics of not really showing a sufficient sensitivity and awareness to the great difficulty, this kind of grey zone that Primo Levi describes, into which the Jewish leaders were placed by effectively being, you know, put in a situation of blackmail by the SS. But, you know, many people found, as I say, this idea of Eichmann as banal, just wildly counterintuitive, historically contestable. Her friend Gershom Scholem, who's a great Jewish scholar of note in correspondence with her, said, look, I'm not convinced. When you read stories of how Eichmann conducted himself in Austria when he was responsible for the deportation of Austrian Jews, when you read stories about how he conducted himself in Hungary when he was responsible for the direct deportation of hundreds of thousands to Auschwitz-Birkenau, it's hard to accept this was just a kind of ordinary man. And Scholem simply says to Eichmann, you haven't convinced me.
At the level of philosophy, you see Arendt's presentation of Eichmann's banality as deeply at odds with itself and ignoring certain evidence. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. She, for example, will claim that Eichmann really didn't act with any kind of initiative, that he was just following orders, you know, that he was a kind of a way station on the conveyor belt, to mix a couple of metaphors, you know, just kind of doing what he was told. Yet she encounters and considers the clear evidence that the prosecution brought forwards that, in fact, Eichmann didn't always do this. And that notably in Hungary, where he was sent from Berlin, he was sent to really get things moving in Hungary. This is in 44. It was pretty clear by that stage that the Russians were advancing and that the Germans were unlikely to win the war. At this point, the project became to exterminate the Hungarian Jews in cooperation with the fascist regime there run by Admiral Horthy. Now, Eichmann defied Admiral Horthy, who wasn't as enthusiastic about this deportation to Auschwitz-Birkenau, where the new ramp had been built in order to try and facilitate the mass murder. And Heinrich Himmler, amazingly, after a certain point in time, realised the writing was on the wall for the regime, and he ordered Eichmann to stop the deportations because he was concerned that he wanted, amazingly, to be able to negotiate with the Allies. And he thought that if he could sort of say that the Holocaust had been halted and that he'd been responsible for that, he might be able to win the respect of the Allies. Eichmann simply defied Himmler at that point. So he defied his boss, which the prosecution was able to establish as a fairly significant show of initiative and indication of intent to carry through the Holocaust rather than just to kind of follow orders. And Eichmann, unbeknownst to Arendt, also wrote a memoir of sorts, a political memoir, which is called The Others Have Spoken, Now It Is My Turn to Speak, or Now I Want to Speak. And in these documents, what we see is a very different Eichmann than the Eichmann at Jerusalem. And the Eichmann that comes out in these Argentinian documents is, in his own words, a fanatical anti-Semite, a warrior for the freedom of my blood, someone who is proud of his role in the extermination of the racial enemy of the German people, who expresses remorse that through his own weakness he was unable to complete the task, which was to eliminate all of the Jews on the continent of Europe, which would have been somewhat over 10 million.
Right. So we have evidence then that Eichmann was an extreme ideologue, also a man of initiative, in spite of Arendt's presentation of him as just this drone bureaucrat. She also asserts that he lacked the independence of mind to be a liar. And this is a really interesting one because you write in your lecture about the centrality of deception to the Holocaust as a whole, but also to Eichmann's role in it. Let's talk a bit about Eichmann the liar.
I guess, I mean, my thinking here is this. If you compare what he says in Argentina and you compare what he says, for example, in Jerusalem that he wasn't an anti-Semite, you have interpretive choices to make. And following Bettina Stangness' work, Eichmann Before Jerusalem, I believe that it's a good deal more likely that Eichmann was telling the truth in Argentina where he had nothing to fear than in Jerusalem where he was on trial by the very people, in some cases, or at least some survivors were present, whom he'd worked assiduously to try to exterminate. So the argument that I make is that on that basis is that Eichmann was in a sense lying in Jerusalem. He was certainly acting a role, and this is Stangness' position, and it's Deborah Lipstadt's position, it's not simply mine, that he was being mendacious, he was wearing a mask. And so what that suggests is when Eichmann is presented by Arendt as someone who kind of wasn't really open to other people, he was sort of just in his own kind of thought world, which was a thoughtless world, if you like, his own jargon world, his own administrative world. That seems to be quite wrong because what seems to be going on is he's playing a role and he's playing to the expectations of his audience and what he thinks is, in the case of his trial, is likely or most likely to get him off the hook. And he entertained hopes that he wouldn't face execution. Those hopes wavered. There are other times where he seems convinced that the Jews will kill him. But he also at other times seems to be convinced that he might be able to save himself, basically. So basically my argument is he was lying. He was playing a role. And Stangeth makes the really interesting point that within the Nazi ideology, within which Eichmann was trained, he was trained during the 1930s, like all SS officers, he went to ideological and military training. The Jews were considered to be sticklers for rational procedures, for bureaucracies, for the rule of law, for legality. They're the people of the law rather than Christianity, which is the religion of love. Judaism is the religion of law. The Jews are sticklers for laws, for procedures, for bureaucracy. And so, ironically, Stangeth claims, if you understand the ideology in which Eichmann had been trained, in which he expresses very vociferously in Argentina, he's ironically presenting himself mimetically as what he thinks his audience will sympathize with and appreciate and perhaps be disoriented by, because they might have been expecting, you know, the glamorous SS officer in his black uniform barking orders, and what they're getting is a kind of mundane, pedantic, book-learning kind of bureaucrat. And Stangeth makes, as I say, she makes the claim that he's kind of mimetically taking on the sort of role of the Jew as presented in some Nazi ideology.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most interesting parts of this whole analysis. So just to be clear, is what you're saying, or what Bettina Stangeth is saying, that Eichmann at his trial is effecting a kind of self-portrayal that he hopes will appeal to the innate instincts, or what he sees as the innate instincts of his Jewish accusers? He's presenting himself as a pen-pushing functionary because the Nazi idea of the Jew is, among many other things, a pen-pushing functionary.
That's right, yeah. That's Stangeth's position, right? And she, of course, she bears that out by citing Nazi texts in which these stereotypes are presented.
on Radio National and the ABC Listen app. This is The Philosopher's Zone. I'm David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Matt Sharp from the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. We're talking about the banality of evil, that famous phrase coined by Hannah Arendt, and how well it stands as a reflection on Adolf Eichmann, the Nazi war criminal, but also on evil in general, evil as a category of human experience. Matt Sharp is going to be talking about all of this when he delivers the annual Simone Weil lecture later this month, and I'll have more details for you at the end of the program. You make a very interesting point about the centrality of deception to how the Holocaust unfolded, in the way that the victims of the Nazis in the camps were lied to at every step of the process that led to their murder. Like, there was a kind of Holocaust denialism built into the mechanism of the Holocaust itself.
Yeah, I'm going from, as you know, from Jonathan Friedland's book on Rudolf Werber, who was one of the few people who ever escaped from Auschwitz-Birkenau. And I think Friedland's book was published last year, and I heard an interview with him on the BBC. And Werber, I think, died in 2021. In any case, this was Werber's big message. You know, he for a time, he actually worked as a Sonderkommando. That is, he was one of the Jews who were selected in order to basically get people off the trains, keep order, and then clean up the mess that had been left, including human bodies, in these cattle trucks that had arrived after between 1 and 8 or 9 days, in some cases, at Birkenau on the ramp. And in Friedland's book, there's a really sad passage, disturbing passage, which relates Werber's observations as a Sonderkommando of how the SS would, at every stage, deceive the victims. When they got off the trains, they would tell them that it was terribly important that they should keep order, that they needed to be deloused because of the terrible trip they'd experienced. If they on some days they would affect upset and shock that the consignment had arrived in such a condition. You know, how on earth did the people at the other end put you in such an awful condition? Then they would be either walked or put on the back of a truck before the new ramps were built in 1944 and driven around Birkenau to the far side where the extermination facilities were located. There was a Red Cross van, for example, that would follow the stragglers who were walking to the crematoria and pick them up. And it had a Red Cross sign on it, and it had a doctor in there. Little did the victims know that the van was also carrying the Zyklon B, which would be used to exterminate them. But, of course, the crematoria that were built after a certain time were presented as baths. There were hooks for people to put their clothing on. People were told that they should tie their shoelaces together so when they came out, there wouldn't be the issue of having to find the shoes. They were told that they would get coffee afterwards, that it was a shower, there were shower heads installed. So the ideal was to keep the peace until you had everybody crammed into the gas chamber presented as a shower, and it would be only when the gas issued from the ceiling that people would become aware of the trap they'd walked into. So the whole thing, Werber pointed out, was predicated on deception. So why he wanted to escape, beyond, of course, saving himself, was he wanted to expose the process, the lies, because he felt that the whole thing was based on lies and deception and concealment. And so it could only be ended by making this publicly known.
We've raised but haven't really explored the question of how Hannah Arendt could have misread Eichmann at trial, in the way that she did. And you suggest a very interesting answer to that question in that Arendt had a pre-existing theoretical perspective that heavily influenced her perception of Eichmann from the outset. So what was that perspective and where had it come from?
So Arendt in 1951 wrote The Origins of Totalitarianism, which is, again, one of the more controversial books of the 20th century. You know, she's a thinker of note who produced consistently provocative, topical material on subjects that, of course, weren't just of concern for, you know, philosophers, but to the world. And in this book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, in part three of the book, she tries to give an explanation of in a sense, how totalitarianism could have worked and how totalitarian ideology, amongst other things, operated. And what's really interesting about her perspective is the claim that Nazi ideology, Stalinist ideology, which she controversially treats as more or less symmetrical or equivalent, people, of course, dispute that. In any case, the argument is that the way these ideologies worked was not to produce convinced fanatics, this is what she argues, but to, in a sense, become post-truth, as we might say, this word that's been thrown around. That is to say, she argues that the ideal totalitarian subject was not the fanatical anti-Semite in the Nazi case or the fanatical Marxist-Leninist in the Stalinist case, but somebody who was so disillusioned and so aware of the mendacity, the falsity, the sort of unreality of the ideology that was being kind of fed through the system to ordinary people, that they kind of didn't believe in anything. They were just utterly disoriented. They were kind of emptied out, thoughtless shells, unable to tell truth from falsity any longer, and so able to be more or less commanded because all the critical resources that might allow them to say, well, that's false, I'm not going to follow that, that's wrong, had just been kind of evacuated through this process of a skillful manufacturing of unreality. I'm paraphrasing one of the sentences in The Origins of Totalitarianism. So, of course, you compare that 1951 to 54 idea with what Arendt says of Eichmann, and the match seems pretty solid, because that's who Eichmann for Arendt was, somebody who wasn't a convinced Nazi, wasn't a convinced anti-Semite, but somebody whose kind of administrative jargon and lingo and way of thinking and proceeding supposedly just insulated him from external reality and the reality of the enormous suffering and injustice that he was enabling.
Well, regardless of how wrong Arendt may have been about Eichmann, and in spite of what I think is a very convincing argument that you're advancing here, I have one or two points that I'd like to raise in defense of Hannah Arendt. And one is that in Origins of Totalitarianism, she decenters, as you've said, she decenters the role of ideological commitment. And what's the quote? The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction, true and false, no longer exist. And I have to be careful here, because I'm not about to suggest any kind of parallel between Hitler's Third Reich and the US Republican Party of today. But isn't this confusion of true and false, of fact and fiction, the dissolution of standards of thought and criticism among the masses, isn't this precisely what the more totalitarian elements on the US extreme right have openly identified as their central strategy? Isn't this what Steve Bannon is getting at when he says you have to flood the zone with shit? You know, it seems like Hannah Arendt is really putting her finger on something here when she writes about the ideal subject of totalitarian rule.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I use that term post-truth, which, of course, came up in 2015, 2016, in the context of the Brexit situation and the rise of Mr. Trump to presidency and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of debate about what post-truth might look like, but one of the arguments about it is pretty much what you've just indicated, that, you know, this is a situation in which we're creating populations which, because of the internet and because of flooding the zone with shit, as Bannon so eloquently put it, people are just sort of no longer able to really discern truth from falsity. And that creates all kinds of problems for democracies, insofar as democracies seem to require the accountability of rulers to the ruled. And accountability seems to require the ability to discern factuality from falsity. And so if that disappears, this is why Timothy Snyder says post-truth is pre-tyranny. And I, for one, am deeply concerned about this. What I would say about Proud Boys and other more extreme organizations that I understand on the American right is they don't seem to me to be post-truth. They seem to really believe the kind of bizarre conspiratorial narratives that have been woven on various places on the internet. Read a lot about QAnon, and we might think of QAnon as a post-truth kind of scenario because it's so bizarre. On the other hand, if you read interviews with QAnon followers, they seem to me to be very, they don't seem to be post-truth in the sense they think that these conspiracies are actually true. And so Eichmann thought that the Jews had started the Second World War. And he then says, well, in 1941, when the Eastern campaign that Hitler started against the Russians was failing, the Jews declared war a second time against Nazi Germany. And it's hard to believe that anyone could really take that seriously, but that seems to be one of the things that Eichmann was reflecting from his ideological training, and he seems to have really, truly believed it. So I guess what I'm saying is I think one of the strategies of someone like Bannon, who I think is a very malign, clever agent, might be, yes, just to bombard people with so much nonsense that they lose the ability to discern true and false. But on the ground, I think a lot of the people who are convinced MAGA people, for example, they really believe that Mr. Trump is some kind of a messianic figure who is being persecuted by the deep state and its liberal front, including the judiciary and so on and so forth. And I don't know which one's more disturbing, you know, the idea of a population that can't tell anymore, which would seem to make democracy on a very short clock, or a democracy in which upwards of 30% of the people seem susceptible to believe stories and ideas that seem to be absolutely historically indefensible.
The other thing I want to ask is whether at the end of the day, even if we accept that Hannah Arendt was duped by Eichmann into seeing him as a bland functionary, isn't the ethical intention of the banality of evil thesis one that should still be honored? Like it still seems important that we should consider evil as something that is not necessarily heralded by ominous clouds or the theme from Jaws or whatever it is. You know, that characterization of evil as more like a sort of latent capacity whose exercise can emerge under very normal everyday conditions. That still seems to be an important message.
I think that's right. Banality of evil thesis is there to warn us that, look, this sort of stuff didn't just happen over there in history in the past. It can happen here. It can happen in the present and in the future. And we ought to be aware of our own potential to become involved in processes that can be immensely damaging to other humans. Then I think it's a very salutary message that Arendt is presenting. However, if the argument is to suggest that any modern society is in a sense prone under almost any conditions, or at least under certain conditions, to become genocidal, then I would want to push back, and I want to suggest that we do need to reconsider the place of ideology. It's no mistake that the Holocaust was perpetrated under the Nazis, who paid a great deal of attention to ideological indoctrination from the very young age to everyone in the population. And my concern with the banality of evil thesis might be that the difference between Nazism and other forms of modern regime can be collapsed. If we're going to say that banality is just a modern thing, it's about bureaucracy, the rule by nobody, as Arendt calls it, then that would be to suggest that there might not be any difference between a country like Democratic Australia and Nazi Germany. And I'd really want to push back against that, because I think it is important to realise that there are extreme ideologies out there. There are ideologies that dehumanise those they consider to be enemies, and that this dehumanisation is considered by the leaders of those regimes to be absolutely vital in producing cadres who can then perpetrate violence against the enemies. And so that's the pushback that I give against the, as I say, the salutary dimension of the banality of evil thesis. You know, the other book that I think should be mentioned here is, of course, Christopher Browning's book on Police Battalion 101. which was a, I think it's called Ordinary Men. It's about a group of police, order police, German order police from Hamburg. They were all middle-aged, so they weren't raised within Nazi ideology and they weren't wholly indoctrinated from birth, who ended up killing upwards of 80,000 Jews in various actions in the East. And his position both supports and doesn't fully support what Arendt has to say. These are ordinary men who have done extraordinary things under extraordinary conditions. And a lot of it, he argues, from the testimony that they gave at trial and in interviews subsequently, seems to have been about peer pressure, about deference to authority, about not wanting to stand out, about not wanting to be criticised by their fellows. But he also adds, there was also the extreme conditions of the war, and there was also the ideological training that they received. So he describes his account as multi-causal, and that, I think, seems to me to be the best approach.
Well, just to finish up, Matt, where does this leave the metaphysical concept of evil? It seems that if we see evil as something metaphysical, it becomes easier to sideline calls for mundane responses like politics or negotiation or compromise, self-reflection. You know, it seems to me that one of the lessons of September the 11th, 2001, and its aftermath is that if you frame your opponent as an avatar of metaphysical evil, then that makes them much easier to drop bombs on, but it doesn't necessarily stop the evil. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's one of the other strong points about the idea of the banality of evil, and this is something that Susan Neumann, in her book on evil in modern thought, has argued in defense of Arendt. She also recognizes in an afterword that Arendt got it wrong about Eichmann, because in the meanwhile, between the publication of the book and the afterword, the Argentina materials have become available. In any case, she sort of says, well, there are real dangers if evil is something metaphysical. One danger might be that we sort of, again, think that it can't ever happen here because it's some sort of a foreign alien force expressive of some level of reality that we don't usually interact with. And that can lead us into complacency. But I think you've pointed out the other issue with, you know, big metaphysical understandings of evil, and the way that if the label is used in that way, it can justify forms of violence. You need to dehumanize the enemy if you're going to commit atrocities. It certainly makes it a lot easier. And one way that you might do that, and of course the Nazis did this with the Jews. The Jews were considered to be the principle of evil, and ironically, the principle of mendacity, of lying. So again, you get that kind of weird mirroring that seems to happen in these kinds of cases. And because they were evil, then of course it became possible to countenance as a quote-unquote defensive action, which is how the Nazis thought about what they were doing. They thought of the Holocaust, and this is really important, as an act of war. They believed that the Jewish people had declared war against them, and so they were defending themselves according to the requirements of war. And so I think if evil is presented as metaphysical, it has that potential that you can kind of throw the label at an outgroup and use it to justify actions that, ironically, would then become potentially atrocious. And so that's another thing that I think it stands in favour of Arendt's position, as I say. My main criticism, as you know, is she got Eichmann wrong. And this seems to me to present an importantly false image of how the Nazis did what they did.
Matt Sharp, he's Associate Professor in Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. He'll be delivering the annual Simone Weil Lecture on Beyond Banality, Deception, Eichmann and Evil on Tuesday, November 21st in Brisbane and Thursday, November 23rd in Melbourne. And you can find a link to registration details on the Philosopher's Zone website. And that's it from the Philosopher's Zone for another week. I'm David Rutledge, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.